High today, 59. Right now, wind from the south at 10. Sunshine with 48 degrees in Racine, 45 in Kenosha, 35 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy Veterans Day to you. We will spend most of the hour hearing from historian Harlow Giles Unger about his newest book, a biography of the great American Henry Clay. Towards the end of the hour, you will hear a portion of my conversation just recorded yesterday with William Doyle, who has written a fascinating book about John F. Kennedy and the PT-109 incident. We'll hear from him as well. This is The Morning Show on WGTD. We're going to be spending a portion of today's morning show talking about one of the most important Americans who was never president. He came relatively close, ran more than once, but never was quite successful. He was, however, Speaker of the House, and perhaps even more important than that, over the course of a half century of public service, Henry Clay carved out for himself an enviable place America's collective affections. Maybe not always at the time, but certainly in retrospect, we now look back on him with great admiration for his firm devotion to save the Union and to fight slavery. And no less than Abraham Lincoln venerated Henry Clay. However, for as great a man as Henry Clay was, he is not sufficiently known by most Americans today. One way to know more about him, to have that right wronged, is to take in hand a beautifully crafted new biography about him called Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. The author is Harlow Giles Unger, with whom I've had the pleasure of speaking on a number of different occasions on the morning show. He is responsible for an array of very, very interesting biographies of great Americans, including, among others, our fifth president, James Monroe. Again, this newest book published by DaCapo Press is called Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. Harlow Giles Unger, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's always a privilege to be with you.
I'm happy to be reconnecting with you. So I think a lot of people, when they take a look at just the cover of your book, will perhaps be taken aback by the subtitle, Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. That is quite a statement you're making there. At least in brief, what leads you to attach such a moniker to Henry Clay?
Well, you can see what's going on in the House of Representatives today and realize that we don't have any statesmen in the House. And the nation is foundering. We're all divided, and things do not look very promising for the coming months. This nation was founded and built on compromise. The Declaration of Independence was a compromise. Half the people who signed it wanted autonomy, not independence. They wanted to stay British. The Constitution was a compromise between slave states and free states. Big states and little states, rural interests and urban interests. And once the national government assumed power, its survival over the next 50 years hinged on five major compromises worked out by Henry Clay, the man I call America's greatest statesman, on the title of my new book. Americans in his day called him the Great Compromiser because his compromises saved our nation from disintegration during the decades that led up to Civil War. Had we broken up at that time, before the Civil War came, had we broken up in 1820 when Henry Clay fashioned the Missouri, the famous Missouri Compromise, we would have been the two or three little nations that would have resulted, would have been overrun by world powers, Spain, France, Britain. But he held the Union together during those years, and that was the great role he played as Speaker of the House. The House of Representatives is the only legislative body that is elected by all the people of the United States. And the Speaker is usually nominated by the majority party, but elected by all of the House. He is not elected by just his own political party. He is called the elect of the elect, one of only two officials elected by all the people. The president, of course, as head of the executive branch, and the speaker as head of the legislative branch. And Henry Clay was elected by all of the people of the United States. And once elected as speaker, the speaker who gets to the House, of course, as representative of his own little district somewhere, once he's elected speaker, he is no longer allowed to vote, no longer allowed to debate. He becomes the representative of all of the people of the United States. His role is to reconcile the many, many differences of all of these representatives from all these various parts of the country with a varied population and a varied geography. Their interests are never the same, and the speaker has to bring those interests together, reconcile those interests through compromise, and that's what's lacking in the leadership of the House of Representatives today. They just can't do it. Or won't do it. They're like children. They really are verging on treason. This is what the southern states did before the Civil War. They eventually seceded, and these extremists in the House today are doing the same. It is borderline treason. They obviously don't believe in the American way, which is based on compromise. And Henry Clay, as I said, was the great compromiser who brought all the diverse interests of this nation, slave states and free soil states, together over 50 years before the Civil War.
As a matter of fact, we are talking in a current political climate in which about the last thing any self-respecting politician would want to be labeled as is a compromiser. I mean, often that is a point of attack from one politician on another if the other has compromised on some sort of principle. We see it now as a position of weakness, an indication of vacillation, a lack of integrity or courage. And, of course, you are pointing to a very different understanding of what compromise is and why it is so essential to our republic.
And in the 225-odd years since the first Congress met, only 5% of all the laws that were proposed have been passed. And that 5%, that small amount, was the result of Congress, because if we are to remain as a union, if this republic is to survive, we have to reconcile the differences between the different regions and different peoples of our country. The interests of the drought states in the far west are not the same as the interests of the flooded areas of South Carolina and the southeast. The interests of the people in the Rocky Mountains are not the same as the people in New York City. But to stay united, to remain Americans, Compromise is the only way, and Henry Clay was the master of compromise, finding the common ground, the things that united us rather than divided us. Nations that have let dissident minority groups take over have resulted in autocracy. The way that these extremists in Congress are talking now, they're talking like Nazis, like communists. They're not talking like Americans who believe in national unity and the preservation of our republic. Henry Clay was the master compromiser. He brought, he found the common ground between slave states and free soil states in the Missouri Compromise by bringing in Maine as a free soil state, and together with Missouri and the newly admitted slave state, it kept the balance of power in Congress equal, so that neither side had a majority, and neither side could impose its will on the rest of the nation. The southern states wanted to impose make slavery the law of the land all across the nation. The northerners, the free soil states, wanted emancipation as the law of the land. Either one at the time would have divided the nation into two or maybe three small, vulnerable little nations that would have been subject to conquest by the world powers. Henry Clay kept these people together as one. And the net result was that over the 50 years of his compromises, by holding the nation together, he was able to institute the greatest political, social, economic scheme, certainly in the history of America and possibly the history of the world. It was called the American System, in which he got these feuding entities, these state leaders and federal leaders, to join together in creating a network of roads, canals, and later railroads that linked all of the northern, central, and western states, 20 states from Maine to California, in this enormous transportation network that allowed tens of thousands of Americans to travel back and forth across state lines and establish interstate businesses, interstate commerce. Farmers bought supplies from suppliers in other states. They sold their produce to merchants in other states. Merchants shipped their stuff across state lines. And tens of thousands of Americans traveled back and forth across state lines. They migrated westward, but they came back to visit their relatives. Their relatives traveled to see them. Suddenly, over those 50 years, Americans who had been locked into behind their state borders by lack of transportation now became Americans. No longer was their allegiance to New York or Virginia or Delaware. They became Americans all, and by the time the Civil War came along, and the southern states, a small minority, starting with South Carolina, whose representative is one of this hardcore group of extremists in Congress, in the House of Representatives right now, they split off from the nation. They wanted to divide the Union, and the people in the Union, it was unthinkable to divide this Union. We were all tied up together socially, economically, financially, in so many ways. We were not going to let a bunch of plantation owners take that away from us.
We're speaking with Harlow Giles Unger. He has just written a book called Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. It is a chronicle of his eventful life and his long, distinguished career in America's political life, a man who really helped forge some of the most important compromises that helped preserve the solidity of the nation during its tumultuous early history. Speaking of tumultuous, Henry Clay, as you describe, did not have, in a sense, the most promising of early childhoods. He comes from very humble beginnings, and there are points of great difficulty in his early childhood. Just say a brief word about that.
Yes, he was basically abandoned by his stepfather and mother when he was about 12 or 13. and became a clerk in a department store in Richmond, Virginia. He was born outside of Richmond, Virginia, on a farm. His father died when he was about 4 years old. His mother remarried. So he was left as a clerk in this department store. And as a clerk, he developed a beautiful handwriting and got a job as a clerk in the courthouse in Richmond. Virginia, by the way, at that time was America's largest, most prosperous state with the largest population. And the courthouse in Virginia was a major institution in American life. The chief judge, George White, who had signed the Declaration of Independence, was developing what we now know as Parkinson's disease. His hands were shaking, trembling. And he spotted young Clay and his handwriting and took him on as his amanuensis, which is the person who does all your writing for you, and basically what we now call a secretary, an executive secretary. White took a great liking to Clay. He was a hard worker, and he taught Clay the law and helped him pass his bar exam and urged him to go up to Kentucky, which had just become a state. Tens of thousands of people were coming into the state, claiming land and needing lawyers to do so. Henry Clay went up to Lexington, Kentucky as a 20-year-old and became a successful lawyer and married the banker's daughter and became even more successful, as well as wealthy.
Right.
Now he was part of the inner circle of the part of the elite of Lexington, Kentucky. And soon, because of his persuasive ways, his eloquent voice, and his marvelous winning personality, he was elected first to the state legislature and then eventually to Congress, and went into Congress, into the House of Representatives, which he found in a state of bedlam. A fellow named Derringer had just invented this little one-shot pistol that you could put in your pocket, and everybody in Congress had one. They would wrestle with each other. They would hit each other. They would roll around the floor fighting like schoolboys, and eventually pull out their Derringers, go outside, fight a duel, and kill each other. And this was the mess that Henry Clay found. One representative from Virginia came into the House of Representatives with two vicious hunting dogs and to protect himself and to intimidate others. Henry Clay put a stop to that, with his wonderful personality, B, with his eloquence as a speaker, and C, with his absolute forcefulness. He brought his gavel down and hammered the House into order. Threatened to throw them out if they didn't obey his rules. And he instituted the rules of the House of Representatives that pretty much exist to this day, with the Speaker becoming the most powerful man, second most powerful man in America, in the federal government after the President. It's he who decides the chair people of each committee, and in turn the members of each committee. He decides which proposals can come to the floor and be presented as law, who can present them and who can argue against them, and how long they can speak. And he can stop them in their tracks if they speak too long. And Henry Clay did that all the time. One old man protested, saying he was speaking to posterity. And Henry Clay replied, "Yes, sir, but we can't wait until your audience arrives. You're out of order." And he made him stop. That's how he took control. And when there were fights, he would bring them together quietly, calmly, behind the scenes, and find the common ground and bring them together and eventually win passage of the appropriate legislation.
Let's circle back to the personal for one other matter, which really struck me as I read your book. He enjoyed a long marriage with Lucretia of more than 50 years, and they had, I think, if I remember correctly, 11 children. We hear
surviving
about
children.
I'm sorry?
Surviving children.
Right. But unfortunately, there were some very Some of those children were a real source of unhappiness for Henry Clay. In particular, two sons we hear quite a lot about, two of his older sons, one of whom was evidently mentally ill, and the other sort of a hopeless alcoholic. And it is so poignant to read excerpts from some of the letters in which Henry Clay sort of expresses his mounting sense of despair, and the way in which he pinned his hopes on some of his younger children who showed more promise. What do you think this effect had on Henry Clay, the fact that there was this great difficulty with some of his own children whom he loved so much and yet saw living lives of ultimate ruin?
Well, there was nothing he could do about it, actually. After all, medicine was not even in its infancy, was in a primitive state, so doctors couldn't help very much in terms of this. But Henry Clay's position was not that different from many others. Infant mortality rates were enormous in those days. In some communities, as many as two-thirds of newborn infants died before they reached the age of one. And that's why many families kept reproducing as often as they possibly could, because they knew most of the babies wouldn't survive. In a few families, such as Henry Clay's, many did survive. So you wind up, for the most part, with families with only one or two children who survive, but some families with 10, 12, 13, 15 children who survive. These are usually the very wealthy families with good food, good temperature conditions in their houses in winter and summer. And this is what happened to Henry Clay. Many, many of his children survived. And when that many children, when that many, that large a number of infants survived in those days, there were bound to be many problems among them, because birth was not a very simple process, certainly not as easy as it is today. And many children were born brain damaged, injured in some way. Many of them did not look very good by the time they were 3 or 4 years old.
Well, Henry Clay forges a very important life, despite the fact that there were these heartaches that were part of his own family, and of course, great joy as well with some of his other children, and it is amazing to think of his political longevity, and his persistence, despite the fact that he was for so many years engaged in the sometimes backbreakingly difficult work of forging compromise. I mean, in some respects, it's a much simpler, easier road to be an extremist on one side or the other versus a compromiser working in the middle trying to bring people together. What do you
That's
think?
Right, but bringing people together in compromise is the American way. It's the basis of the foundations of this country. And apart from his compromises that saved the nation, that preserved the nation, for 50 years, his influence on others of also believers in the American way was enormous. By coincidence, the next-door neighbors was the Todd family, whose daughter, Mary Todd, grew up next door to the Clays and eventually married Abraham Lincoln. And as Lincoln wooed and then married Mary Todd, Clay became the young Lincoln's friend and mentor. And before he became president, Lincoln had served in Congress, where Clay had made compromise the guiding principle. President Lincoln said and these are Lincoln's words, "I can express all my views by quoting Henry Clay." And indeed he did so. When Clay died just before the Civil War began, Lincoln gave this stirring eulogy. Looking to heaven and cocking his ears, he said, "I recognize Clay's voice speaking as it ever spoke for the Union, for the Constitution, for the freedom of man." And when Lincoln finally sent Union forces to war, he explained why in words that really might have been those of Henry Clay. Henry Clay had said, the paramount object of my public life is the preservation of the Union. President Lincoln, when he sent the Union troops to war, he said, my paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery, I do because I believe it helps to save this Union. And what I don't do, what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. Abraham Lincoln listened to Henry Clay, as have all the great statesmen and patriots in American history. We just have to hope that Congress will start listening to Henry Clay and do the same thing and preserve this Union.
I wonder, there are so many high points and we just don't have time to explore them all, but one moment that I think is worth our talking about a little more specifically centers around the issue of slavery. And it is a very, very dramatic moment in your biography when you tell us about an extraordinary speech which Henry Clay delivered, February 7th, 1839. You call it one of the most dramatic speeches of his career, when, among other things, he not only spoke out boldly on the issue of slavery, but violated some sort of gag rule which was in place at the time. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about this extraordinary moment in his career which speaks to his great courage?
Well, the problem he had as a lawyer and as an American was differentiating between state sovereignty, areas of state sovereignty, and federal sovereignty. And at that point in American history, before the Emancipation Proclamation, states that made slavery legal included Henry Clay's home state of Kentucky. Now, he owned slaves. He could not free them. Under Kentucky law, it was illegal to free your slaves or emancipate them in any way. On the other hand, he was not necessarily religious, but a deeply moral man who hated the institution of slavery, felt it was sinful and immoral in every respect, and he was an abolitionist in heart and in person. He was one of the founders of the American Colonization Society to help resettle slaves in their homelands in Africa. So he was an abolitionist at heart, but he could do nothing personally to free his own slaves under Kentucky law, and this tore at him throughout his lifetime, as it did many, many slave owners. You must remember most of the famous American founding fathers from the South all owned slaves, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, but they had inherited them. They didn't go out and buy slaves, and they hated the institution. Unfortunately, it was a fact of life as they grew up. They were born with slaves on their properties. Indeed, no one in the South originally wanted slaves. In the early 1700s, Queen Anne of England started shipping slaves. The slave trade was the biggest revenue producers for England. And there was a surplus. Most of the slaves, all of the slaves at that time were shipped to the Caribbean sugar islands to plant and harvest sugarcane. There was an abundance. There were just too many slaves. She didn't know what to do with them, and started shipping them to the American colonies and the tobacco states like Virginia. The Virginians in 1715, the tobacco growers there petitioned Queen Anne to stop sending slaves. They were more of a burden than a help. They didn't speak English, and they didn't have the skills for planting, harvesting, and treating tobacco. That is a skilled trade. It's not an unskilled trade like picking cotton, planting and picking cotton. By the time the founding fathers were born, slavery had existed for 2-3 generations, and the British had flooded the area with slaves. There was nothing they could do. There were no cities in the South. There were no apprentice programs. There was no way to learn a trade. To free a slave would be to send him down the road to the end of one plantation, only to find another dirt road leading into the next plantation. There simply were no opportunities in the South for slave labor. So they were caught in this web with no answers to the problem. The South became really vigorous about retaining slavery after the development of the cotton fields, which uses unskilled slave labor, and the cotton growers made a fortune out of slavery. The tobacco growers didn't. George Washington, of his 300-odd slaves, complained that one-third are babies, and he has to take care of them. One-third were old and crippled and couldn't work. So they were a heavy, heavy burden on planters like Washington.
So he delivers this amazing speech in 1839, and tell us what he said that was so dramatic.
Well, he said that there was nothing we could do in the southern states to emancipate the slaves, and that the North should get about its own business and take care of the widows and orphans next door and stop creating this conflict with the South, which cannot be solved, that could not be solved at this point. And, of course, that compromise, in effect, cost him presidential consideration by his party three times.
Ultimately, was the fact that he was never president a source of any sort of resentment or bitterness or anguish for Henry Clay? Or did he, as far as you can tell, as far as we know, understand his important place in his country's history and in the hearts of Americans?
Well, in his one of his most famous quotes is, "I'd rather be right than be president." And so he felt he stood on the side, and he did, on the side of right in this country at the time by holding the nation together and not caving in to these partisan regional interests. He also was the consummate politician in the sense that what's passed is passed. Get on with the show. If you fall on stage, get up and sing your next song, deliver your next lines. There's nothing you can do about the past. So he never never grew bitter or allowed any kind of bitterness to interfere with his work, with his primary object of preserving the Union. Mm. I'd say the only true political anger that ever entered into his life was his conflict with Andrew Jackson, first during the War of 1812, when Jackson took it upon himself to invade Florida. In the post-war of 1812 period, in 1818, when Jackson took it upon himself to invade Florida and conquer Florida for the United States. Americans hailed Jackson for doing that, but Clay castigated Jackson for violating the Constitution. The president had not given him orders to go into Florida, and he did it on his own. It was a violation of every aspect of international law and a violation of the Constitution.
What about the fact that we do not know Henry Clay well enough now? Has it always been true, or in the years after his death in the early 1850s, did most Americans remember and revere him? I mean, at what point did he fall into such obscurity?
Well, in 1852, when he died, he was revered by Americans as the great American leader. He was the first ever to be, whose body lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington. No other American had ever lain in state, not even Washington. Well, there was no Capitol building then. But he was the first to lay in state. His train carrying his coffin, draped in black, went through Baltimore and Philadelphia, New York, up the Hudson River. Throngs of people crowded the riverbanks along the Hudson to mourn. Cannons fired their salutes. He got up to Albany. The coffin was put on a boat on the Erie Canal, which was part of this great American system of transportation that Henry Clay had helped build. So he and eventually taken to Buffalo, then by boat to Cleveland, by train to Lexington, where he was buried. So he was mourned by the American people as no other American had been mourned since Washington and Franklin. Since then, of course, the Civil War broke out 8 years later. That killed all memories of Henry Clay. In 1854, the Southerners got control of the House of Representatives and repealed the Missouri Compromise. They repealed many of his compromises and, of course, went to war. So that kind of obliterated the memory of Henry Clay. But it's very, very difficult for any House Speaker ever to gain the kind of national acclaim and reverence that Henry Clay did. Remember, the Speaker is elected from the membership of the House, and these members come from tiny little districts somewhere that most Americans have never heard of and don't care about. So when he is finally, or she is finally elected Speaker, the name is completely new to most Americans. The people in the Speaker's district know the Speaker's name, but not the rest of Americans. And the job of the Speaker is to act quietly and bring all these conflicting interests together to try to get them to agree, to reconcile the differences of the people of the United States. And you don't reconcile differences by screaming and yelling and making speeches and going on television. You do it behind closed doors, quietly, pointing out how each side stands to gain. And yes, this side will lose, but that side will lose something as well. Compromise means everybody will gain just a little bit, a little piece of the pie, but no one will gain all the pie, and some may even gain smaller pieces than others. So there will be sacrifices on all sides, and that's not the kind of negotiation that you do in public. You do it quietly, behind closed doors. You don't succeed most of the time. So it's not a job that is going to get your face in the national press or rarely gets you in the national press or on television today.
Well, on that note, we end this examination of Henry Clay, his long life, and very, very important political legacy. Indeed, it's not an overstatement to say that you and I and all of us as Americans would most likely not be here in the America in which we live were it not for Henry Clay and his tireless works to on behalf of the Union to keep it together. This biography of him again is called Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman, published by Da Capo Press, and its author, Harlow Giles Unger. Mr. Unger, it was great to reconnect with you, and thank you for writing this important book about this very important American.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on your show. It's always a privilege to be with you.
And the time is 8:49. This is the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. On this Veterans Day, Veterans Remembrance Day, I am very, very excited to be able to connect with a highly regarded author by the name of William Doyle. And perhaps you know him from a much-discussed book called American Gun, A History of the U.S. in 10 Firearms. He has just published a really interesting book for William Morrow called PT-109, An American Epic of War, Survival, and the Destiny of John F. Kennedy. Many of you, I'm sure, know at least something of the incident during the Second World War, in which the boat which young John F. Kennedy, 26-year-old John F. Kennedy, was captaining, was struck and sunk. And it is a harrowing tale of survival against all odds. And it is the contention of William Doyle, among others, of course, that this incident really shaped who John F. Kennedy ultimately became. And so we have the next few minutes to speak with William Doyle about the extensive research which he did in order to bring this event to life in such thrilling detail. Again, the book is called PT-109, An American Epic of War, Survival, and the Destiny of John F. Kennedy. And William Doyle, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Going into this, you obviously had heard of this. Most Americans have heard something of the story of JFK and PT-109. Did you know more about it than most of us do? And how much of this did you uncover through the course of researching the book and putting it together?
Well, the idea for the book was my editor, Peter Hubbard's idea. He said, how about a book on PT-109? And my first thought was, boy, hasn't that been done before? But let me take a look at it. And it turns out that much of the story really has not come to light, in my opinion. What I was able to do is, and this is a very important story in American history, because this event literally created the political career of our most admired president today. John F. Kennedy consistently ranks at the very top, or the top, of all the polls among American people as to who they admire among modern presidents. And if it wasn't for PT-109, there would be no President John F. Kennedy. That quote is from Kennedy's longest-serving aide, Dave Powers, and I believe him. And what I was able to do was find incredible detail from interviewing a man today who's 96 years old, a veteran of World War II named William Liebenau. Believe it or not, he was John Kennedy's tent mate, his battle colleague in the battle where Kennedy lost his boat, got run over by a much larger Japanese destroyer. And 7 days after Kennedy was presumed to have been lost with his crew, Bud Liebenau was given the extraordinary job of going out at night without any radar on his boat, 40 miles behind enemy lines, to try to rescue the starving and dehydrated survivors of PT-109 at night on a remote jungle island. That's Bud Liebenau for you, a veteran today who's 96 and helped me with a great deal of interviews for this book. I found Japanese military archives that had never been mined before for a book on this subject. I found seven eyewitnesses to the battle that occurred. And I found an amazing volume of material in the Kennedy Library, just extraordinary detail on the event, which in my opinion is one of the great ripple points in American history. We hear of turning points. This actually was a ripple point that set off an incredible series of events that culminates today in Kennedy's daughter, Carolyn Kennedy, being the ambassador to Japan. And earlier this year, 2015, she sat down with the widow of the Japanese destroyer captain who tried to kill her father. Now, how's that for American history in action?
Incredible. Tell us more about the long-lost firsthand account by John F. Kennedy himself, written very shortly after the conclusion of the war. First of all, did you even know of the existence of this document? And tell us more about it and how useful it was to you in reconstructing what occurred in this incident.
Yeah, this is an amazing document. John Kennedy rarely spoke about PT-109. I think he was embarrassed by it because there was controversy over whether he was negligent in the events preceding the crash. He certainly behaved heroically in the events
after the crash, trying to keep his crew together. But he never spoke about it in detail, except for this document that I found with the help of archivists at the Kennedy Library. It's really amazing because it's the only detailed firsthand account he ever gave of it in his own voice. And it's only been quoted once or twice in tiny fragments in what I think are non-relevant sections of it before by other people. This document, which I reproduce to a large extent in my book, is he talks about how he was warned that there were destroyers specifically in that area at that time. That's new. He talks about his crew member, the emotional impact of Kennedy himself seeing his crew member burned terribly and stranded along with the 11 other survivors. Think about this. Middle of the night, abandoned by their fellow PT boats who took off out of there because they saw his boat blew up. Now Kennedy has 10 other men. Two men die instantly, by the way, 3 feet from Kennedy. 11 men are scattered on the open ocean in the middle of the night, several of them wounded terribly, and they have no food, no radio, no weapons to speak of, no boat to get home with, and they're stranded 40 miles behind enemy lines, surrounded by Japanese-held islands, and below them is 1,200 feet of water down to the ocean floor, infested by man-eating sharks. That's the dilemma that Kennedy and his men faced, and he had to figure out how to get them out of there, how to get them to safety, and how to get them out of the death zone, because the islands there had no water or food. So they were really in a kind of a cosmic dilemma there.
To say the least. I think I misspoke earlier. I think I attached the wrong age to John F. Kennedy, but he was very, very young when this occurred and relatively inexperienced. Just tell us how young he was and what sort of experience he had behind him leading up to this incident.
Yeah, you're right. He was in his mid-20s, but he was very green. He had never been in direct combat with the enemy before, as you know, many of them had not been. My own father was a junior officer in the Army on the next island over, New Guinea, which was across a very large body of water from the Western Solomons where Kennedy was. And, Kennedy, amazing thing about John Kennedy is he was super wealthy. His father pulled strings to get him into the PT boat service, and his father said to the top PT boat officer, essentially, listen, keep my boy out of harm's way. Give him some action, but not too close to the action. Now, John Kennedy maneuvered, to his great credit, maneuvered himself around that and demanded to be put on the absolute edge of the front line of combat between Japanese-held water and American-held water. And it was really a turning point period in the World War II. We hear about, of course, about Midway and Coral Sea. But the Solomon Islands campaign, which really began with Guadalcanal, was a long battle that saw the pendulum largely swing from a stalemate into the eventual march on Tokyo that the American Navy, Marines, and Army successfully made. This is where it really started to turn. Almost at that same moment, August 1943, that Kennedy's boat was destroyed and he was assumed to be dead. Hmm.
William Doyle, his book about John F. Kennedy and his brush with death and his heroic efforts to save his men, told in this new story, in this new book called PT-109. We will be airing this interview in its entirety on Monday's morning show. Tomorrow, it's the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council, and on Friday, a look at the history of neuroscience with Tom Jackson, the author of a book called The Brain. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. partly sunny and mild, but becoming very windy later with a 20% chance of late afternoon rain, a high of 59 degrees, cloudy and very windy overnight with rain showers and scattered thunderstorms right around midnight, a low of 45 degrees. We'll be under a wind advisory all day tomorrow, winds up to 45 miles per hour. Also a 40% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high, 49 degrees. Windy as well on Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR.